a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The headlines around chips and chip manufacturing from the Biden administration have been bullish that America could lead out. Also, Nancy Pelosi held that similar position when she took a trip to Taiwan. The question is, are there really the ability within the U.S. to execute and deliver on that promise and that vision, or is the U.S. over its head in hopes to produce essential microchips? That's the question of the day. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
Well, when it comes to technology and chip manufacturing in particular, of course, it's an area that the United States would love to have a little more internal manufacturing going on, less dependence around the world. And we wanted to get into that just a little bit beyond the headlines of what's been happening in Washington, D.C. And Alex Burns, who's the associate editor for Global Politics at Politico, had a great piece on the visit that Nancy Pelosi took to Taiwan under very difficult circumstances. But the messaging in terms of where we really are as it relates to our ability to manufacture and really lead out in that industry. And Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a great piece. And so let's start with the then Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. Give us just a little bit of the backstory and some of the conversations that were had there.
Sure. I appreciate your interest in the piece. This was sort of a really striking piece of reporting that I came upon. I think a lot of people remember last August, that trip that Pelosi took to Taiwan, as you said, under very, very difficult circumstances, with a lot of threats and pressure from China not to make the trip. She was greeted, she had this rock star reception at the airfield in Taiwan, all the way on the motorcade to her hotel, at her hotel, and then throughout the visit. What my reporting really focuses on is a meeting that she had at the presidential palace with Taiwan's president and a number of major tech executives, including a man named Morris Chang, who's the founder of TSMC, the most important microchip manufacturer in the world. Chang is 91 years old. He's sort of the godfather of Taiwan's tech industry. And over the course of this lunch with other folks from Taiwan's tech industry, the speaker, his own president, members of the U.S. Congress, he just lectured Pelosi at great length about what he saw as the very, very severe deficiencies in the U.S. microchip strategy. And actually the deficiencies, not just in the strategy, but in the U.S. sort of structurally as an economic competitor. And he sort of begins in semi-lighthearted way by, you know, referring to the amount of money that was allocated in the CHIPS legislation, saying $50 billion, that's a good start. Basically, like, you guys think that $50 billion is going to buy you a world-class semiconductor industry. You're kidding yourselves.
I think that's so fascinating. And again, for all of the rhetoric we heard around the CHIPS and Science Act, a $52 billion package of subsidies for semiconductor manufacturing. I found that comment just it was almost kind of the pat on the head moment, like, oh, how cute, 50,
totally.
50 billion. And so dig into that a little bit more in terms of some of the messaging there, because I think it really does transcend just the semiconductor business. He was really saying, hey, there's some other soft spots and structural deficiencies in terms of really continuing as a major player on the world stage.
That's really right. And I think that's the sort of broader lesson to take away from this, that he and some of the other executives in the room were really pointing to what they saw as sort of non-competitive traits of the United States that are particularly problematic when you're manufacturing something as complicated as semiconductors. So they're talking about sort of relative lack of workforce development in the high-tech engineering field that Chang said then. He has said in other contexts as well that basically over the last generation, most of the big talent in American business has moved out of manufacturing and into finance and into computing and other kinds of technology, but not in actually building things. The U.S. just doesn't have the talent to make it work.
Wow, I think that's so
interesting. There's concern.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say
that. Concerned by
you. Go ahead, Alex. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, we could do this all day. But he and the other executives sort of raising concerns about whether the U.S. really understands the complexity of sourcing the materials to build a microchip. So we've all heard that it's a complicated supply chain, but in their view, Taiwan has really figured out how to make sure the materials are moving into the plants when they need to be moving into the plants and out of the plants and into products in a sort of efficient way. And basically, their view is, you guys think you're going to build, about four or five or six sort of regional semiconductor manufacturing hubs? Well, how are you going to build the whole ecosystem around them to make sure that they have the stuff that actually goes into the product?
Yeah, and I find that so interesting. There was another line that you had in your piece that I wanted to get to, again, from Mr. Chang in his conversation with then-Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, because I think this is so instructive, where he said there's a long distance between the cutting of government checks and the creation of a self-sustaining chip industry in the United States. Dig into that just a little more for us.
Well, the key word there is really self-sustaining, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to cut a big check at the front end so that the plants get built in the first place, right?
Right.
But sort of Chang's observation, it's certainly not an observation unique to him, is that the semiconductor industry is evolving incredibly fast. And so if you build a huge plant in Arizona, which TSMC is actually doing right now with support likely from the Biden administration, you build a giant complex in Arizona to manufacture chips that are maybe not the absolute most cutting-edge products on the market now, but, quite good and important for supplying Apple and other American manufacturers, you are going to find that that plant is out of date sooner than you think. Mm. And then you're faced with the question of, are you going to cut another $50 billion check to do it all over again? Or will you have created an industry that is sufficiently robust and sufficiently successful on the market that actually these companies are going to keep on investing in the kind of innovation and updating of their hardware that you just have to do in order to stay competitive?
Yeah, so interesting. And before I let you go, Alex, as you look forward on this, based on all the people that you've talked to around this, obviously there's a long, long way to go. There's an interesting balance in terms of what the government can do and how far that takes you. All of those ancillary things that you mentioned in terms of that ecosystem that has to be there that doesn't just automatically pop up when government infuses money into a particular company or a particular manufacturing plant. What are the other things that we should be watching in the months ahead as it relates to this? Clearly, this is an important piece of some national security components and supply chain control components. But what else should we be looking for or talking about as you see this thing play forward?
So I would say two things. One, you mentioned national security, and that's sort of central to the whole conversation. Part of the reason why we did the CHIPS legislation to begin with, and part of why Taiwan has sort of strong reasons to be critical of the CHIPS legislation, is because right now we're so dependent on Taiwan for the microchips industry that if China were to start a war over there, so the global tech industry is just sort of debilitated by that, right? Mm-hmm. So for Taiwan, it's a very valuable strategic reality. It gives the U.S. and others a really strong incentive to try to deter China from starting a war. But the challenge here is that setting up a microchip industry doesn't happen overnight. So if China has, they have indicated that they want to be in a position to take Taiwan by force by 2027, we should sort of see that as the ticking clock on having a very strong semiconductor industry, and that is a really tight timeline to make that happen.
Yeah. What else has to be done in order, if that is the timeline, and I think that's a really important date that you point out there, Alex, what else do we have to do in order to make meeting that timeline a reality?
Well, that's sort of bucket two of things to think about is, you know, there's semiconductor policies, semiconductor policy very literally, and then there's the set of policies around semiconductor policy that could have a really outsized effect in determining whether we're successful or not. You know, some of the other Taiwanese executives in the room with Pelosi were really pushing her on American environmental law and American labor law. You guys want to set up a really big, really lucrative industry really fast. Are you really going to subject all these projects to a cumbersome months or years long environmental review? And that's a giant question mark in this, much as it is for the Biden administration's clean energy policy. And secondarily, I would say, immigration policy potentially plays into this in a really, really important way. We clearly need to train a whole lot more engineers in this country and high-tech engineers in this country in order to be competitive in this space. But that takes a long time. And you know where they have plenty of high-tech engineers is a lot of other places in the world. So if we want to set up this industry really fast in a really sophisticated way, there is a very, very strong argument to be made for enabling high-skilled immigration and allowing people to get their high-tech education in the United States to stay here more easily. But as your listeners certainly know, nobody has ever lost money by betting against Congress doing something on immigration.
Yeah. Great insight, as always. Alex Burns, Associate Editor for Global Politics at Politico. And this is why we have to go beyond the headlines, because we can start by talking about chips and investing $50 billion. But then this underlying component that Alex just pointed out that I love. What about the environmental components, the regulatory things, the permitting process, the litigation, and then immigration? Nobody's talking about that in terms of how we actually become independent and really lead out in that semiconductor business. Alex, as always, appreciate your perspective. Great piece, great beyond the headline reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Again, that's why we do this Think Again, because the headline's easy. We're investing $52 billion to lead out and be independent when it comes to the semiconductor manufacturing. And that's great. But as the people in Taiwan well know, $52 billion is just a nice start. And if we need to do it quickly, if we're worried about China influencing Taiwan, then we got to pick up the pace. And in order to pick up the pace, guess what? You got to get past the regulatory hurdles just to build the plants. You have to get past all the litigation pieces just to get there. And then we got to have people to work there. And that's going to require some immigration reform. And so we always have to get beyond just that comfortable headline of, oh, what a great thing. You got to get down to the nitty gritty, the what happens on the ground, where does the rubber meet the road, and where do the chips actually fall? We'll be right back.
Think Again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson on Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
A lot of international news happening today. Currently, United States President Joe Biden is giving a historic address to the Canadian Parliament today in Ottawa. They are also getting ready to take some questions from the press. We may dip into that live, depending on their timing there. It's also been a very active 24 hours for our military as well, after a drone strike in Syria killed a U.S. Contractor and wounded five others. Our military, the U.S. military, of course, has responded with a retaliatory strike against the terrorist group responsible. And we want to dip into a little bit of that as well. We'll give you some insight in terms of the president's address there at Parliament in Canada today. But let's start at the Defense Department. Defense Department spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryder held a press briefing just about an hour ago and gave a description of the attack on a U.S. base in Syria and the U.S. response.
Secretary Austin, at the direction of President Biden, authorized U.S. Central Command forces to conduct precision strikes into eastern Syria against facilities used by groups affiliated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The airstrikes were conducted in response to yesterday's attack, as well as a series of recent attacks against coalition forces in Syria by groups affiliated with the IRGC.
Pat Ryder went on to say that the terrorist group carrying out these attacks are, at least in some part, sponsored by the nation of Iran.
We know that these groups are sponsored by Iran, so Iran certainly plays a role in terms of ensuring that this type of activity doesn't happen.
So as we look at how that plays out there, again, such a challenging area of the world, one other thing that came from General Ryder, he talked about the objective and our continued military presence in Syria, which, of course, is focused on the defeat of ISIS, that terrorist group and organization.
Our focus in Syria is on the defeat ISIS mission, and that will remain our focus. We do not seek conflict with Iran. We don't seek escalation with Iran. But the strikes that we took last night were intended to send a very clear message that we will take the protection of our personnel seriously and that we will respond quickly and decisively if they are threatened.
Again, very important messages coming out of the Pentagon today in terms of U.S. military action there in Syria. Again, it was a U.S. contractor that was killed, and then a number of members of the military were injured in that attack, and then the U.S. responded, carrying out an attack against that group, a terrorist group connected with ISIS most likely, and Iran. So we'll continue to monitor that as that plays out. And again, it's a challenging place in the world, and our influence in it is also at a very interesting place, especially as we look at what China is doing to assert influence in the region. We know they've been very active, of course, with Iran and Saudi Arabia brokering a deal there. And so, again, what does that do to the U.S. position and influence in terms of carrying out that mission that General Ryder spoke about of defeating ISIS and continuing to keep them out of play in other parts of the world? And so that's just an important region and multifaceted now, especially with China trying to assert its influence there, not just economically, not militarily, but diplomatically, which is just an interesting way for China to do that. Again, I think China is playing chess to a lot of the world, playing checkers and just responding move by move to what China is doing. China seems to be three moves of chess ahead of our one move of checkers. And so we'll continue to watch that. President Biden, as I mentioned, has been addressing the Canadian Parliament today. In that address, he said that the U.S. will keep its alliance with Canada strong.
Ukrainian people, love of their country, is going to prevail. In the face of President Putin's aggression against Ukraine, Canada and the United States are also making clear our commitment to our NATO allies. We'll keep our alliance strong and united. We'll defend every inch of NATO territory. An attack against one is an attack against all.
Attack against one is attack against all. That will continue to be the drumbeat and the battle cry there in terms of what is going on with NATO. The president also emphasized that he's looking forward to working with Canada to watch over NORAD and what that means in terms of things like spy balloons.
NORAD is the only binational military command in the world. NORAD is the only binational military command in the world. Yet another way in which our partnership is exceptional. It is an incredible symbol of the faith we have in one another and the trust we place in each other's capabilities. Soon, NORAD will have a new next-generation over-the-horizon radars to enhance our early warning capacity, upgraded undersea surveillance systems, modernized infrastructure that's necessary to host the most advanced aircraft. And I'm looking forward to continuing to work in close partnership with Canada as we deliver on these needs so that our people can continue to rest soundly, knowing NORAD is in the watch.
So very important, obviously, that surveillance, early warning mechanisms, making sure there are a place for those advanced aircrafts to be launched from, and all of that in terms of protecting that crucial airspace from Canada on through the United States. One other area of many that the president hit in a rather sweeping speech before Parliament there in Ottawa, Canada today, the president announced that he's committed to working with Canada to tackle our public health crisis.
We're tackling the scourge of synthetic drugs that are devastating Canada and American communities, particularly our young people. Fentanyl is a killer. Almost everyone knows someone who has been affected by this, lost a child or lost a friend. Canada and the United States are working closely with our partner Mexico to attack this problem at every stage, from the precursor chemicals shipped from overseas, to the powders, to the pills, to the traffickers, moving into all of our countries. And we all know synthetic opioid epidemic has its roots around the globe, not just here. So today we're announcing a commitment to build a new global coalition of like-minded countries led by Canada and the United States to tackle this crisis.
So an important part of that conversation there with Parliament in Canada, in Ottawa today, the president laid that out in terms of the opioid crisis, fentanyl in particular. And I think part of that he was really saying to China. So this interesting connection between China, where a lot of the raw materials are produced, they're often shipped to Mexico, where they are put into pill form, pressed into pills and so on. And then they come across the border. And again, just as a reminder, they're often brought across the border by American citizens and distributed to American citizens at legal checkpoints. And so we have to be very careful of the sweeping generalities when it comes to these synthetics and fentanyl in particular. And it's not one you just do by doing things right at the border. I mean, because it's so small, because it's so potent, it's so easy to move through a little bit at a time. And a little goes a very, very long way when it comes to those that are addicted to those substances or those who may be thinking they're buying other substances. And then having the devastating effect of fentanyl being packed in there as well. So those are just some of the topics that the president hit. Again, it was a very wide-ranging, sweeping conversation with Parliament. We're still standing by to see if they will take some questions from the press. We'll bring that to you as it warrants. One of the things that we know is on the president's agenda today, as it relates to Canada, is dealing with asylum seekers. And obviously this has been a real challenge for the United States at the Mexico border. And it's also a challenge for Canada at the U.S. border. And often what they're trying to look at is what do you do with the asylum seeker who has gone through a country, whether that country is Mexico or whether that country is the United States? If they came to the United States illegally and then stepped into Canada and said they were seeking asylum, but they didn't seek asylum when they were in the U.S., they're trying to navigate and look at that in a little bit different way, and vice versa, those who may have come illegally into Canada and then come across to the U.S. border and claim asylum. And so that's part of this ongoing conversation that we have to look at as it relates to asylum seekers. And the challenge, of course, is that there are many who just are using that as the default to come across and ask for asylum. Versus those that really are being persecuted, that really are in danger if they stay in that country. And it's just part of our system that we've got to get straight, we've got to get right in order to deal with those that are those sympathetic cases that are the very nature and the very meaning and essence of what it is to be America. We've got to make sure we get those border issues done and done right. All right, we'll go ahead and step aside for a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to introduce you to a new segment. I know the 2024 election seems very, very, very far away. It's not. It's right here. It's heating up. And we're going to break it down every Friday at 1:50. So stick around. We'll give you a sneak peek coming up next.
get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson, and I know it seems like we're just slogging through the snow here. We're just wrapping up the first quarter of 2023. In terms of presidential elections, it may feel like 2024 is a long way away, but it's already heating up in a pretty significant way. And something we're going to do every week is we're going to give you a little bit of the lay of the land. We're not going to give you horse races. We're not going to give you what the latest, you know, just only the polls and who's ahead and who's behind. As always, we're going to try to go beyond the headlines. We're going to look at the candidates. We're going to find out what makes them tick. We're going to look at their communication strategy. We're going to look at their path to victory, what areas might be their pitfalls, and how most candidates lose, not because they don't have the right strengths, but because their weaknesses become the dominant force in their behavior. We will start this segment always with something, a little formula I came up with about a decade ago, and it is simply this, that trying to understand the behavior of someone running for president is like trying to smell the color seven. Now, for those of you who are driving, I'm going to repeat that just so you don't swerve off into a snowbank. Trying to understand the behavior of someone running for president is like trying to smell the color seven. Now, I know my wife might say that's how she tries to understand my behavior on a regular basis, or maybe the staff here looks at it that way, too. But it's often interesting to see the crazy decisions that get made, the head-scratching decisions that get made, some of the speeches that will be delivered that you'll say, wonder who was in the room when that was decided. And so we're going to get into all of that as we go over that. So every Friday at 1:50, you can set your clock. We'll do a little bit of smell the color seven as we look at presidential candidates and the presidential race rolling into 2024. So we want to start this week, again, with just a little bit of the lay of the land. Obviously, there's much more action going on this week on the Republican side than there is on the Democratic side. So we'll drill in there. And earlier this week, I actually interviewed Scott Shepard, who covers elections for Politico magazine. And we talked about the path forward for the current presidential candidates. Here's what he had to say about the former president and his current position in the polls.
He's currently the front runner. He's currently the leader in the polls. And, you know, the path for him is fairly simple. You know, nothing that disrupts his position. Now, unfortunately for him, there's a lot that's going to happen between now and late January or early February when these primaries and caucuses kick off. There's a long way to go until then. And so, you know, you could also easily plot out a path in which he kind of falls off from that current frontrunner position.
I also asked Scott Shepard about another possible candidate that we've been following very closely on this show, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina. Here's what he had to say about the senator and one of his unique strengths, which is his incredible ability to raise funds.
You know, he has an interesting story to tell. He shares, though, that home field advantage in South Carolina with Nikki Haley, and he is certainly a favorite of the party's donor class. He raised a lot of money for his reelection campaign in the last year and has made some important connections with some well-heeled national donors who could set up a potential outside group to do some advertising for him if he does decide to jump in.
So it's really interesting as you look at all of that. I think and am becoming increasingly convinced that Senator Tim Scott is going to get in the race. I've been talking to a number of sources, a few former senators who are part of a super PAC that I think would end up aligning if Senator Scott throws his hat in the ring. And so we're going to watch him. He has an incredible story. Again, he's from South Carolina. His grandfather worked in the cotton fields. He was raised by a single mother in his grandparents' home. And he really believes in a very positive view of the country and that upward mobility is possible for everyone. And again, he's a happy warrior. He has a very optimistic message. So he does not buy into a grievance mentality. He is not a this is what we're against kind of candidate. And it's going to be very interesting to see if he can get traction in that space. And if the American people from the center left to the center right are ready for a different kind of conversation when it comes to those running for president. I think Senator Scott has a very interesting path, and if you look solely at the polls at this moment, you'd say, well, he's got no chance. He's at about 2%, which means if the polling is plus or minus 4%. He could technically be negative 2. But I think he would take that as a badge of courage. And again, it's so early that I think he's just one to watch in terms of the messaging. And I also just want to point out there that often when we look at polling this early, I'm not looking at the numbers and who's at 10% and who's at 40% or whatever, because those things change so rapidly. In fact, if you go back and look in 2016 and in 2020, in 2016, if the race stopped at this point, Rudy Giuliani would have been the nominee. And if he stopped at this point in the game in 2020, Beto O'Rourke would have been the Democratic nominee. So there's lots of things that are going to happen, and that's what we're going to get into, is what is it under the surface that's making all of that happen? One last thing that I talked to Scott Shepard about was the differences between Senator Tim Scott and other folks like the former president and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
He's offered a funnier version of the Republican Party than what you've heard, especially from the former president, when he talks about this campaign being about retribution. That's not the kind of rhetoric that Tim Scott uses, and it'll be an interesting test to see what kind of appetite there is for his funnier version of Republicanism or conservatism in this primary, running against Trump and DeSantis, who are, you know, just sharper-edged in general in the words that they use.
So I want to dig into that a little bit further, which I did earlier this week with Carly Cooperman. Now, Carly is the CEO of Schoen Cooperman Research. They get behind the numbers better than anybody. And so as they looked at that from the current Republican candidates, particularly in regards to this idea of a grievance message versus this more optimistic, hopeful, this is what we're for message. Here's what Carly had to say.
I don't think the grievance mentality is in campaigning is really effective at the end of the day. And I think we sort of saw that with what happened in the midterms, because, you know, one of the criticisms Republicans had is that they didn't really put forward an alternate approach on any of the issues where they were attacking Democrats for. So I certainly hope that as the primary season progresses, which is still very early, but, you know, and things go underway, that there is some substantive discussion about, solutions and policy to these issues that are facing our country and, you know, that everyday Americans care about.
So that's our first look at what will be a very entertaining, very interesting election cycle, both on the Republican side and on the Democratic side. Of course, the president has not announced his reelection run yet. We expect that to be coming in the next few weeks. We expect Senator Tim Scott to be joining probably mid-April. Governor Ron DeSantis, I predict, will happen sometime in June. You also have Nikki Haley, of course, who's already in the ring, and a smattering of others that we'll continue to watch. And as always, we will remind you that trying to understand their behavior is like trying to smell the color 7. We're going to help you make sense of what those candidates for president are doing and talking about, what it means to your world, what it means to your future. So stay with us. We'll do that every Friday at 1:50. All right. That wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for top of the hour news. Much more to come, including an important conference going down at UVU. International implication there. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson on Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, today in Ottawa, Canada, President Biden spent a good portion of his address to Parliament talking about Ukraine. But if you think that Ottawa is the only place talking about critical elements to Ukraine and what is happening there, there's somewhere much closer to home that is also convening a crucial conversation about Ukraine. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
Well, it's time to think again, and the Think Again place is right down the road at Utah Valley University today. An important conversation convened there at Utah Valley University. Global ambassadors, diplomats, state officials gathered both in person and virtually at UVU to engage in a global conversation related to international relations. And the topic, as I mentioned this year, is Ukraine. So we want to get past the headlines and look at some of the conversations, some of the things that might be overlooked in the regular press and flow of the day, and look at some things differently as it relates to Ukraine and Russia and where things are. And we're really thrilled to be joined on the program today by Dr. Fred White, a professor of Russian and Integrated Studies at Utah Valley University, a key player in some of the conversations today. And Dr. White, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have a vast history and experience as it relates to Russian literature, film, culture, and just a deep insight there. And so really curious, first, give us a sense of the event down there at Utah Valley today. What were some of the conversations? Where was the focus?
Yeah, so actually the event on Monday, and we're going to start off at 9:30 on Monday, with a kind of an opening session, but the heart of the matter will start at 10 o'clock with a keynote speaker, Stephen Siegel, who's a professor at University of Texas at Austin. And Professor Siegel is going to talk about kind of Ukraine from the Ukrainian perspective, kind of fight back a little bit that the notion that Vladimir Putin has put out that Ukraine really isn't a sovereign, independent nation, that it's really just part of, you know, Russia. Mm. And so Professor Siegel is going to kind of take that on a little bit. And I think that's really important for those of us who maybe don't know history from the Ukrainian side of it. And then we're going to move on into a really important, I think, roundtable session, and that'll go from 11 a.m. until about 12:45. And we're going to have several people participating in that round table discussion. So the Consul General of Ukraine will be there, the Honorable Consul General from Poland, Consul General from Romania, and Consul General from Spain. We will have a representative from the U.S. State Department, and Dr. Siegel will also take part of that. And we're going to talk about a lot of different important issues like Ukrainian refugees and if there's a plan for their long-term relocation, things about around energy security and food security that has been disrupted because of the war, reconstruction, you know, what is the plan? Is foreign investment possible? And then I think one of the stickier questions that, of course, we'll talk about is, is there any path forward for Ukraine to be included in organizations such as the EU or NATO? So that's the kind of the general plan for Monday's events. And I think it's going to be a really fantastic event if people can make it out.
Yeah. And that is, again, on Monday down at Utah Valley University. And this is just one more example of where Utah Valley University is punching so far above its weight. And credit to President Tomines and the entire staff down there for gathering this kind of intellectual firepower when it comes to these kind of conversations. And it's exciting to look at some of those topics in terms of how we get there. We've been talking a lot in terms of this idea of the rebuild, and was curious your perspective there in terms of some who are starting to say, look, the rebuild actually has to start now. We know the war is not over. But you've got to have infrastructure. You have to have places so people can work and rebuild their lives. And you can't wait to the end to do that. You've got to create a space for people to come back to or to really fight for.
You're absolutely correct. Actually, today, President Zelensky met with members of the World Bank to already begin that conversation. The estimate is somewhere around $411 billion to rebuild Ukraine presently. And I mean, if the war continues, of course, that number could go up. But certainly, unless people get involved and start making commitments now, it's going to be hard to rebuild or, you know, really too late to rebuild once, say, a peace plan is in place. It needs to start now. You're correct.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to tap into your expertise on, Dr. White, is just amongst the Russian people. You have great insight there. So as you've study Russian culture, the Russian people. Can you give us some perspective on how the war is taking a toll on both the Ukrainian and the Russian citizens, not just the leaders that we see day to day?
Yeah, well, I think the toll on the Ukrainians is probably more obvious to us. I mean, when you're under constant bombardment, that's, life-threatening. For the Russians, it's a little bit harder to say. The reality is that most of them are not getting accurate information. The state, the Kremlin controls most of the news sources. Just recently, you probably know, we had Dmitry Muratov, the journalist, on our camp as Nobel Prize winner. And Mr. Muratov explained to us that there really is no independent journalism occurring now. So, most Russians are getting a very mediated form of the news in which somehow Ukraine is the aggressor, that somehow Russia is liberating them from Nazification. It doesn't always make a lot of sense. But then, totalitarian states put out whatever information they choose to put out. So, most of my Russian friends who realize that Russia is the aggressor, they're just trying to keep their head down. This isn't the moment to necessarily put your head up, because you can be punished, and the punishment is quite harsh. You can lose your job. You can face other kinds of censorship. So, it's one of those moments once again in Russian history where everyone's just hoping that it'll come to a quick end. Yet the quick end doesn't seem to be obvious to anyone quite yet.
Yeah, and then final question for you. Just as you've studied kind of the culture and the literature and so on, what can we learn from that in terms of how that might play moving forward? Obviously, Vladimir Putin, as long as he has that ironclad control, is one thing. As you mentioned, it's hard for people to raise their head up if they're worried about losing a job or being sent to an education camp. But what have you learned from the history, the culture, the literature, the Russian people that we might be watching for as maybe a game changer, a tipping point?
Yeah, as we know from Russian history, things change rapidly and unexpectedly. The Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 was rather unexpected. Even Lenin, you probably know, was in Switzerland at the time, because Lenin didn't think the revolution was going to happen. The putsch of 1991, when they tried to take Gorbachev out of power, and this actually allowed Boris Yeltsin to kind of come onto the political scene. What it all tells me is that probably Putin will be replaced, or something drastic will happen at the moment when we least expect it. Mm. That's probably what I would take away from Russian history.
Great insight. Dr. Frederick White, professor of Russian and Integrated Studies at Utah Valley University. Again, Utah Valley University convening a crucial conversation with a focus on Ukraine coming up on Monday. And it is open. You can check that out. There'll be some important conversations. Again, there's ambassadors, consul generals, members from the State Department visiting. Those will be amazing conversations. And I love that Utah Valley is convening it. And again, hats off to President Tomines and the entire team down there at Utah Valley University. Dr. White, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Again, that's Dr. Frederick White, professor of Russian Integrated Studies. And this will be an amazing day down at Utah Valley. Diplomatic Conference on International Relations. Ukraine 1 year later is the topic. And those will be crucial conversations, lean-in conversations, coming up on Monday. Check that out at Utah Valley University. All right. We will step aside. We're going to come back and go really close to home. We're going to go to your neighborhood with our good friend Brooke Walker coming up next. Stay with us.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Earlier this week on Monday, we had the host of Studio 5, KSL TV, Brooke Walker, joined us on the show to talk about a wonderful challenge and a great focus that she had with her viewers going on during this week. It was all about your beautiful neighborhood. The challenge included everything from silent service to knowing your neighbor, taking a mindful walk, bragging on your neighborhood. And as always on this show, we want to look at not just the idea, but then what actually happens. And so we're really pleased to have joining us on a Friday, Brooke Walker. And Brooke, thanks for jumping on.
Oh, you know I like you if I'm here on a Friday.
Yeah. It's the ultimate test of friendship. Will you show up on a Friday afternoon?
I'm so glad to follow up. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's dive into this because you challenged your viewers to not just think about it, not just talk about it, but to actually go out and do it. And so I want to get some perspective of what happened out there in the amazing neighborhoods around the state. And I want to start with this whole idea of neighborhoods are more than just a nice nostalgic thing. There's much more to it than
that. Yeah, one thing we saw, and it was so impressive to me how involved our viewers became in this challenge and also in this topic of conversation. And there was a lot of emotion. In fact, I think you asked me earlier in the week what surprised you about this topic or this series, this movement. And my answer, and I could still answer this way, was that there was so much emotion tied to people's reflections and people's memories and people's celebrations of their neighborhood. And I started to think about that. You know, nostalgia is kind of an interesting feeling because it's kind of all consuming. It's this combination of grief and gratitude. And that nostalgia can feel like this all consuming, overwhelming emotion. But underneath, as I listened to everyone's emotion this week and kind of, you know, opened my ears and my heart to their nostalgia, underneath every single memory or every single story they shared with us, was a chance to develop a core value. We heard about, you know, especially this week, hello spring in Utah. We heard about a lot of neighbors, you know, feeling gratitude for the snow shoveling that was happening and the memories they had of neighbors serving them. And underneath that is service. We heard a lot of nostalgic stories about, you know, night games on the corner. We didn't go home until the street lamps came on. And, you know, the value behind that is this lesson to play fair. One viewer shared with us that she remembers as a little girl waking up, you know, in the middle of the night sometimes to find different neighbors sleeping on her couch because her mom had just had triplets. And so the neighborhood was on rotation, helping that couple, those parents, through the nighttime hours with three young babies. I mean, that sacrifice to give up your bed for some neighbor's couch. Block parties, you know, the value there is how to share in joy. We actually heard some really touching moments about neighbors who showed up during times of loss at funerals, and there you have the value of sharing in each other's sorrows. So it was really sweet to consider not just the nostalgia and the memories and the emotion that comes with that, but that behind that are these really strong core values that we're learning from our neighbors.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I love that. So I'm just going to pause for a second because I want our listeners to just let that sink in. Nostalgia is not just a nicety. It's what's underneath it. So like everything else, we have to go beyond the headline of, oh, nostalgia is great. Nostalgia is a nice thing. There are values. There are principles underneath that, from communication to sacrifice to service, real meaningful things. And that leads to the next thing I want to get to with you, Brooke, and that is how our neighborhoods shape us. Sometimes we say we shape our neighborhoods and then our neighborhoods shape us. Tell us how you saw that play out this week.
It sort of was a for good or for not kind of a thing, that your neighborhood does, you know, become part of who you are. We carry with us those attitudes, those examples, even the culture of the physical, you know, area, the surroundings that swallow us up. And that includes what we say. You know, we threw out some interesting questions via social media. There was a really entertaining thread that we were getting some giggles over. We asked what phrase or word was part of your neighborhood vocabulary. And certainly this ties into our Utah culture here locally. But what's a word or a phrase that stuck with you as an adult? It was kind of a lighter, funnier moment. People were saying things like, oh, my, I had a next door neighbor that said, oh, my stars. And now I say that to my kids. I had a neighbor who said hell of a over the church pulpit. Now I find myself saying that now and then. And then one viewer was like, I had a neighbor across the street that always said hot diggity dog. And wouldn't you know, hot diggity dog, I say that to this day. So little quirks that we sometimes roll our eyes at or maybe feel are cheesy or maybe not as reflective of who we want to be stick with us in ways that we don't realize.
It's so important. We talked on your show. We actually talked about President Biden, and you talk about someone who was shaped by a neighborhood. You know, I think if we all got a quarter for every time he references Scranton and his little neighborhood there, we'd all be rich. And we might be able to take out the national debt. But those things do shape us in such an important way. And as you said, Brooke, for good or for ill, our neighborhoods do make a difference for us, which really should put it on all of us to do our part to make sure. What are we doing to add to the positive shaping that and influence that our neighborhood can have?
Exactly. What's the attitude? What's the example I'm putting forward? What's the culture that I'm helping to create? Because it does shape more than just who we are, but it shapes all of the people around us.
And then I want to get to my favorite part, and that is your neighbors are part of your story. Describe how that's played out this week.
you know what? This has probably been the biggest, most poignant takeaway for me as I've kind of had a front row seat to what's played out on Studio 5 and online this week. I, as you know, Boyd, I've dedicated a large portion, a majority of my career to the topics and the content and the conversations that strengthen home and family. And as I've done that the last 20 plus years, I've professionally been validated toward a personal core belief that I have, which is your family unit is not just by chance. Like we are part of a family unit or a family structure by design, whether it's weird Uncle Bob or the sister-in-law that you find annoying. All of these characters are put into our lives to help teach us and help shape us. And I found myself translating kind of that personal core belief about the family unit to neighbors this week. There was a really still moment in the studio, and you know how busy and bustling a studio can get, but Dr. Liz Hale, our Studio 5 marriage and family contributor, she captivated us all with the question, what if the person that you need really is just over the fence? Mm-hmm. Like, just as I described the family, you know, our family members being kind of players and characters in our lives that were sent here to shape us, what if the neighbors that are surrounding us are part of that story or part of that refining process? A lot of people put a lot of thought, energy, prayer into where you live. It becomes a really important decision for you and your family. And I started to think, I don't know if the people that you end up living by are by chance. I just thought that was a really poignant thought. And we had some viewers chime in with really, really touching stories of how their neighbors have become part of their story. Viewer Kelly Hughes described a neighbor by the name of Skip Hoover. She said, she was a second mom to me. We played in her house, in her yard. She came up with all sorts of crafts and games and treats for us. And her love continued as we grew. If my mom was not available, she was always there to rescue us. Her loving care extended well beyond the strength of our neighborhood. Jeannie Bisson was another viewer, and she described a neighbor of hers growing up named Ethel Ball. She said she was an angel, and she and her family were so kind and helpful to me when I was a teenager, and matters in my home were chaotic and difficult. Her teenage daughter, who was also an angel, became my best friend. I would not be the person I am today if it weren't for her. Mm. And this story by viewer Nat Jensen totally touched me as well and gave me a smile too. She said, I sold Kool-Aid on our non-busy, quiet street corner. Our neighbor, John Gunter, drove by all afternoon up and down the street buying and leaving tips. Best and only customer of the entire day. Only later, she said, did we discover we left out the sugar. I love these stories, boy, because I think they describe these characters. I mean, you can say the neighbor down the street is quirky, that neighbor is a little crazy, but ultimately they all are part of our story. Yeah. And perhaps they're here to teach us something and to refine our own spirits and our own selves into better people along the way.
Oh, I absolutely love this. Has been an amazing thing to watch play out on your show this week and on social media. And I would just echo, never, ever underestimate the power of a neighbor, especially in the life of a young person. You may think they're way beyond you. You may think they're completely disinterested in you. The power of a neighbor on a young person can be absolutely transformational. Brooke Walker, you always lead us to better places and spaces, and we're so grateful you led us to our own neighborhoods this week, and appreciate your work on Studio 5 for KSL-TV. Thanks so much for joining us and being part of our neighborhood.
Thank you, Boyd. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. We're going to go to the global neighborhood next. The annual report of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on giving and charitable contributions came out. We'll talk about that coming up next. Stick around. We'll be back on Inside Sources.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints issued their 2022 Caring for Those in Need annual report with a statement from the First Presidency of the Church that says, Jesus Christ is the perfect example of caring for those in need. As His followers, we seek to love God and our neighbors throughout the world. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is eager to bless others and to help those in need. We're blessed to have the ability, resources, and trusted global connections to carry out this sacred responsibility, which we consider a joyful privilege. I love that statement, and it's a great way to begin, and we're very pleased to have joining us to break this down just a little bit, Samantha Butterworth, Director and Program Manager of the Welfare and Self-Reliance Services Department for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Samantha, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is one. It is just striking in terms of the breadth and depth of the service that is being provided by the church. Over $1 billion in need, but there's so much underneath that. The more I looked into the report, the more I thought, oh my goodness, there's so many stories to tell here. But start by just giving us kind of the high level numbers and activities and projects the church has been involved with.
Sure. So, you know, as we reported, there were $1 billion in expenditures, and that is separate. That does not include the 6.3 million hours of volunteer effort that were also contributed on top of that. This past year, we had over 3,600 humanitarian projects in 190 countries and territories around the world. So just a tremendous effort that represents the generosity of the members and friends of the church, and also just the giving of their time in service.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And I want to get to each of those components. And let's start at the high level. There were some extraordinary monetary donations on the international level. Give us a sense of those.
I think one of the largest ones is the $32 million that was donated to the World Food Program. And this is just such a significant project, I think. It's going to benefit people suffering from acute hunger. So in a situation where they're actually wasting or starving in 9 countries around the world, that would include countries, you know, like Afghanistan, DR Congo, Haiti, Yemen, and others. But what I love about that project, you know, and as we get more information back and as the year unfolds, you'll start to see how the projects in each country are really tailored to that unique need. Mm. So you might see in some countries where they're choosing to focus on maybe school food programs because that's where they know they can reach children who are having this need. In other countries that deal with extreme weather and other circumstances, their projects might focus on pre-positioning food in preparation for events and, you know, weather events that might come up. And I think that's what I found most interesting about that project is the most effective humanitarian aid happens at a local level with those decisions being made locally.
That's so important, and I love that local focus. It is amazing when you actually get down to that level in terms of making that happen. I know one of the other things that the church has done, especially with some of these larger donations, is really make sure there's that accountability piece in terms of results, that we're really focused on what results are we getting, whether that's the food program or whatever the specifics. They're always looking for not just a good donation, but for the right result.
I think you really hit on it. You know, it is a lot of work and effort to expend that kind of money in a responsible way, in a way that benefits both the people intended, the beneficiaries, but also in a way that promotes building up the infrastructure around them, you know, both to promote self-reliance of the community as a whole, to enable them to continue to make decisions about their own future, you know, but also to help build those local economies, which is why we focus on so many local efforts.
Yeah, I love that. And I know another big part of that local effort is building self-reliance in many of those communities. Tell us about some of those projects.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I think many people locally here might be familiar with the self-reliance courses that we offer. You know, there are courses around maybe personal financial planning and emotional resilience. And we had last year over 106,000 people who participated in that. But I think you can also look at building self-reliance as just a principle of how we approach humanitarian work. You know, it's really important to recognize and honor the dignity and the agency of people involved. And so, you know, one of the stories that I love that came out of last year is the story of Dohat. He is a young father who had to leave his home in Syria. And we had this joint project with Al Jahoots, which is a Jordanian charity. And they provided him with beehives and with training around those beehives. Mm. And over the course of a couple years, he was able to double the size of his hives and be able to make choices for his family, you know, move his family into a home, send his children to school. And that's really what it's about is respecting people and knowing that they have the agency to make decisions for themselves. And our role is to provide, you know, what resources and support we can to empower them to make the choices that they want to make for their lives.
That's so important. And again, that result and that upward mobility and opportunity is such an important part of that. Also, I know that you also have a focus on the Just Serve program. which sometimes we look so big and so broad that we forget there are so many things right in our own neighborhoods and communities. Give us a sense of the Just Serve growth this year.
So with Just Serve, you know, it's available now in 14 countries, and we've been really excited to see these parts of the world start to request that. Just Serve is meant to be a community resource. You know, it is supported by the church and kind of viewed as a gift to the community. So we're really pleased to see it being able to be offered in these additional countries. Last year, we had almost 70,000. We had 69,000 new registered users, and we're working with 14,000 organizations. So Just Serve, what I love to see about that is it allows people to find a cause that they care about and be connected with the organization working in that space.
I love that. And just last and very, very quickly, Samantha, if you look at some of the partnerships that the church has created, some of those are interfaith partnerships. I know there's over 550 in the U.S. and Canada and 225 internationally, as well as other organizations. But give us a sense of what those relationships, those interfaith connections in particular, have produced.
You know, I love that you zeroed in on those interfaith connections, because for me personally, when I have opportunities to go out and serve, that's what I find the most inspiring. You know, we work, and I will name a few, but I hate to leave any off the list. But, you know, Catholic Charities, Church World Service, ADRA, which is the Adventist Relief Agency, Islamic Relief, and just so many others. And what I love about working in these interfaith partnerships is just this recognition that we share good intention. And when I look even at my own job and what value I'm giving back to this work, we really are trying to help people overcome the barrier between good intention and action. Mm. So when we partner with our friends in these faith communities, we're all together recognizing that spark of inspiration that comes, you know, and, you know, asking ourselves, when was the last time you had a good intention and you didn't follow through, you know, and what stopped you from following through? And so as we look at this work that we do as shared faith communities, I think we're recognizing the inherent goodness in people, and we're all trying to crack that same nut. You know, how do we help people overcome that barrier to action? How do we leverage just the grassroots benefit that comes from a faith community who tends to live, you know, in the communities they're trying to serve, who understands the culture, who understands the need, who has a long-term investment in what's happening in that community? You know, as we come together in these faith communities in recognition of kind of this good intention we know exists, faith communities have deep roots in places that need help. We have the relationships, we have the grassroots organization to mobilize volunteers. And so really what we're trying to do in this shared space is find that spark to help people act. You know, whether the barrier is, I don't know what to do, or maybe I'm a little afraid, you know, I'm afraid to put myself out there, or I'm busy and overwhelmed, I need someone to help me plan, but please, yeah, you know, I'll show up and help. That's really the beauty of our partnerships and our working with these faith communities.
Oh, I so love that. And overcoming those barriers between good intention and action. I think we could use a course on that in a lot of places and spaces, but that is so perfect. Again, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints put out their 2022 Caring for Those in Need annual report. On the numbers side of things, over $1 billion for those in need. But it's underneath that the real power is, in terms of these projects with large organizations, local efforts, self-reliance, interfaith. And as Samantha just said, that's how we overcome that barrier between good intention and action and really bless the lives of many. Samantha, thank you so much for spending time with us. This is an extraordinary effort, a great work, and I know there's much more to come.
Well, thank you for allowing me to talk about something that's just so wonderful.
Again, over $1.02 billion. That's extraordinary impact all around the world. That's what making a difference in your neighborhood looks like, sounds like, and acts like. We'll be right back.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America. but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.